Welcome to Open Book. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Nick Olivero, who's the artistic director of Boxcar Theater in San Francisco. Currently, four shows in repertory Sam Shepard plays: True West, which is playing through April 7th at their Hyde Street Studios; Buried Child, also through April 7th at the theater on Natoma and 6th; A Lie of the Mind through April 14th at the Natoma Theater; and Fool for Love through April 14th at the Hyde Street Studios. We're going to go into the history of Boxcar, some of the controversies about Boxcar, as well as this particular series of plays, these Sam Shepard plays. Let me start with that a little bit. I know Sam Shepard got his start in San Francisco at the Magic Theater. He was a playwright in residence. And in fact, I think two or three of these plays actually got their first performance in San Francisco.
Three of them, I believe. All but Lie of the Mind premiered at the Magic. True West, which had Peter Coyote in it. Fool for Love. I actually contacted Will Marchetti, who played the original old man, to see if he would be interested in coming back as the old man again. He was not. I think he's lived that part of his life. And then Buried Child, which he won the Pulitzer for. And then I think Lie of the Mind came out later in maybe in New York or something.
True West, Buried Child, and Fool for Love are part of a quartet of what he calls the family tragedies, the fourth being Curse of the Starving Class. Right. Why did you do Lie of the Mind rather than Curse of the Starving Class?
Susanna Martin, the show's director, wanted to do Lie of the Mind. It was between those five shows. True West was going to happen because I love True West. I've actually directed it twice, and I've always wanted to perform in it. And Fool for Love, which was supposed to originally be, it was going to be in a motel room when we originally had this idea to do it, which since kind of went out the window, was on the docket. And then Buried Child, of course, is just a brilliant play. It's one of his best plays. And Rebecca Longworth had wanted to direct that one. And I was still looking for another director. I didn't really care if it was Curse or Lie of the Mind. I actually don't think I've read Curse of the Starving Glass, and it's been a long time since I had read Lie. So I didn't really have an affinity towards either one, so I just kind of left it up to the director. And Susanna Martin wanted to do Lie. She's directed Fool, and she's done a few other Shepard plays, and she's always wanted to do Lie of the Mind. It's a beast of a play. It's very difficult.
Why did you choose to do Sam Shepard in repertory? Now, a couple of years ago, you did a number of plays. I guess it was
Tennessee
also
Williams.
In repertory,
yeah.
Which was Tennessee Williams. Why Sam Shepard? Why now?
When I originally had the idea to do rap was when I went to Berlin maybe 3 or 4 years ago. I was at the Berliner Ensemble Theater, looking at the calendar and how amazing it was to see Nathan the Wise, followed by Mother Courage, followed by Threepenny Opera. And that was the impetus of saying, let's do something in rap. And someone had also told me about Signature Theater, which I just loved the idea of celebrating a playwright. And so I kind of combined those two ideas, neither of which are my, as you know, I take other people's ideas a lot and then change them. I'm sure we'll get into that.
Oh, yeah.
Signature Theater isn't a model for us for a whole year, but every other year to do rep, I love the idea of celebrating a playwright. When we first started talking about this with Peter, who's now my former artistic director partner, it was narrowed down between Tennessee Williams, Arthur Miller, Sam Shepard. We kind of talked about Pinter. We talked about a couple other people. We wanted to make sure that people came and saw these shows. It really became why we weren't doing other people and how it kind of got narrowed down. So Arthur Miller is phenomenal, and I really want to do Miller in rep, but it has a lot of older characters in it. Finding older actors in the Bay Area who are talented and in our pay rate and non-equity or whatever is few and far between. There are some wonderful older actors, and we have them already, but there's a lot of roles to fill. So Tennessee Williams luckily focuses on a lot of younger actors. There's a plethora of talented younger actors in the Bay Area. And so Tennessee Williams kind of won out that first round. And we always planned on doing just the hits, you know, doing Streetcar Named Desire, Cat in Hudson Roof, Glass Menagerie, because people know those shows. It was also a bit of a challenge for us to say, how can we take a show that people know so well and then find something new within that show, which I feel like we did very successfully with Tennessee Williams, and now Sam Shepard we're finding out as well of how to bring something new to light. Because they're hard. There's a lot of iconic moments. There's a lot of stigmas that are attached to it, and it makes your job just a little bit harder, and it keeps you on your toes. It's not a cakewalk with some of the more unusual shows by him.
Well, Nick Olivero, you came to San Francisco in 2003. 2007 is when you opened the theater. You began producing in 2005 with something called site-specific performances. Do you think this is unique and one of the reasons why you're trying to create single-set shows? I mean, is that what Boxcar is about?
The first 5 years of the company was really a journey to figure out what the company was. I mean, you know, I was fresh out of college when I moved out here, started the company a few years later. Originally, site-specific theater came out of a necessity. We didn't have a theater, and we didn't want to pay someone else. You know, your whole show budget goes towards paying, you know, a landlord. So we found ways around that by working on the beach, working on buses, working in people's living rooms, and we would perform in places for free. So we were able to produce more often, faster, quicker. We could put more money into other areas like costumes, sets. And then the Playhouse on Natoma came available, and we decided to take that opportunity to a lot of groans from people who were used to seeing our site-specific. So we had attempted to keep doing one show a year, site-specific, you know, museum, performing in actual museums. We did American Dream in living rooms and in a furniture store. We continued doing at least one show a year, and then we got to Little Shop, which we decided to kind of do site-specific in our own neighborhood. We performed on the street and did the opening number out there and had permits to close down the street to perform outside. Fool for Love was supposed to be in a motel room, but just with the monstrosity of the four shows and a few other things, we decided to keep it centralized within our theater spaces. But I'm looking at, in the future, going back to site-specific, I actually have no plans to produce currently in either of our three theaters at all next season.
What happens? You just rent out the theaters?
Yeah, Crowded Fire's company in residence, BOA, they're going to be doing the Bay 1X starting pretty soon. And Michelle Iannaro, who's one of our company members, is going to be producing a show on her own. There's a few other theater companies that we help support, and we rent the space out to them.
Well, let's go back a little bit to the beginnings of Boxcar. Now, you were a theater major, graduated college. You were in Chicago, and you decided to come out here and began just as an actor, and that's where you met Peter Matthews?
I wanted to start a theater company in Chicago, but there's so many. I mean, there's over 200 at any given time, and I just didn't feel like it was the best place to try and start another company. So focused on San Francisco and started working at the Magic Theater, which I've always had a huge love for. When I first read Sam Shepard in high school and flipped and said, you know, where was this done? And said, oh, the Magic Theater.
Was Chris Smith there then?
My first year was Chris Smith's first year. So I became the audience services manager at the Magic, worked there. And then I got involved with Killing My Lobster, which is a sketch comedy group, and Lunatique Fantastique, which was a object puppetry company. And that's where Peter and I first met at Killing My Lobster. And then he told me about the show he was doing with Lunatique and decided to do that. And then it was our second show. It was my second show in the Bay Area. I had done a few with Killing My Lobster since then. But anyway, at that point, we started talking about forming a company. So I never really claimed to be an actor. I just do it because especially when I was younger, it was easier to get an acting job than it was to get a directing job.
When you came up with the name, it's kind of based on a drink.
Yeah. When we were applying for the Fringe Festival, I needed a company name, and I was talking with Peter about names for the company. We couldn't think of one. We spent like 20 minutes. He said, as a completely side note, we interrupted the conversation because we had gone out a couple of weeks earlier to the Huntington Hotel and with his 9-to-5 job. And there was a bartender who was teaching us how to make mixed drinks. It was the old fashioned, the martini. And by the end of the night, there was this one that was really good, but we couldn't remember it because we had been drinking all night long. And he goes, I finally remember the name of that drink that we liked so much. It was called the Sidecar. That quickly turned into, oh, Sidecar Theater. We could name ourselves Sidecar. I said, well, we can't name ourselves after an alcoholic beverage. You know, what else does sidecar mean? And he goes, well, it's also that compartment next to a motorcycle. And I said, well, there's got to be another definition. Let's look it up. And there were two definitions. And one was the alcoholic beverage, and the other one was, you know, the attachment to a motorcycle. So I was like, we can't name ourselves after a drink. So we started riffing on the word side, on the word car, and ended up coming up with Boxcar, which also happens to be an alcoholic beverage. So now we have Boxcar Theater, we have Sidecar Theater, which is our second stage, and Caboose, if we ever do any educational programming, which we have in the past, is our children's wing. And Caboose actually happens to be a non-alcoholic beverage, which I think is kind of fitting.
When you and Peter Matthews were originally talking, and this goes back to that question I asked earlier, why your own theater company? What was the thought behind creating another small theater company?
It just sounded like a good idea. I'm going to have my own company. I'm going to do my own work. It's incredibly challenging. People have asked me if such and such company were to come along and offer you, you know, a job, would you take it, an artistic director job or an associate artistic director? I'm like, hell no, I got to flip a coin on that one. You know, it's tough to build something from scratch. And if you look at all these companies, I mean, Bill Ball with ACT or, I mean, even the folks at Steppenwolf, it's like you the people who found the company, they're giving themselves heart attacks, building the company to what it becomes, and then they leave. And then someone else, you know, waltzes on in and gets to take it over. That's kind of a cush job to a certain degree. You know, it's tough. You got to live up to those expectations, but a lot of that groundwork has been laid for you. So I always say I'm laying the groundwork for someone else to have a great company 15 years down the line.
You know, your choices and site-specific performances, that's fairly unique. I remember seeing The American Dream in an apartment relating back to these Sam Shepard plays, and even Clue and Little Shop to a lesser degree, what you might lose in lighting and set sometimes, you make up for in intimacy. I mean, you're right on top of the action.
Yeah. Yeah, it's someone asked me, it was either yesterday or the day before, as an audience member, said, why do you do these such intimate shows? You know, what's the deal with this? And I said, well, I'm just making lemonade. You know, I have an intimate theater. So instead of trying to treat it like a proscenium, you know, a 800-seat proscenium theater and doing Jesus Christ Superstar in a 49-seat black box theater, you know, I'm going to choose an intimate show where you should be inside of the action because you're going to be. That's the physical location that we have. So at True West, for instance, the audience is in pretty much the round. We've blocked off a certain chunk of it because there's a lot of violence. And if you're familiar with the show, obviously there's, you know, hitting of typewriters and throwing stuff around. So there's a lot of violence that you need to protect the audience from. But we call it the splash zone. We have audience members between a refrigerator and a stove that's inside of our kitchen. Just two people sit right there, and they're like literally on stage with us. And they get an incredibly different experience than the people who are even just in the third row in the, you know, the main section. So we've just tried to use it to our advantage and have people feel like they're part of the production. And some people really like it.
Well, I also noticed at the Natoma that you had completely ripped up what you had done and created a new theater, in a sense, with new seating for Clue. If I recall correctly, the seating for, say, Rent Boy Ave, the stage is in a completely different place than it is for Buried Child. You've kind of turned everything around.
Peter and I would joke that we need to get a new theater because we've done every single possible, after 5 years, it's like we've done every possible seating configuration we can think of. And then Clue came around and we're like, all right, we can lift the audience 6 feet in the air. Now what else can we do? It's been a challenge. But when we did Tennessee Williams, we did all three shows in the Playhouse. We had just taken the lease at the studio, so we were just building it. And I was really big that I wanted all three shows to be completely configured differently. So when the audience would walk in, they would be in a traverse theater, like table tennis, audience in a round, audience on three sides, and it kept changing, which made changeovers and lighting incredibly difficult because you're lighting three different stages with the same instruments. So the designers weren't incredibly happy about the changeover crew, but the audience loved coming in and just seeing how the space would be reimagined for every production. And that's something that I really try to push for every production, is how we can tell the story with the space. And how that can be a part of that. Because the audience is part of the space. They're inside of it. They're sitting there. So why not encourage them to kind of witness and participate in a different way? And not by grabbing them and bringing them on stage. You know, it's not that kind of participation. It's just feeling like you're part of the action. You're inside the world. We do a lot of treatments to the walls behind you, the seating that you're in. When we did Headspace, which wasn't particularly one of our best plays, but the seating I thought was really, really interesting. We talked about the life of this one woman. It was her past, her present, and her future. And we had seating on one section where her past was, and there were bunk beds, and, you know, you had to climb a ladder to get there, and we had, you know, soft, cushy. So all the seating changed, too, depending on where you sat. By the time you got to the present, it was much more formal, and you're sitting on nice couches. We didn't even use our chairs. We just used other kind of seating. So it kind of helps tell the story, in my opinion.
For True West, you're using one studio space, and then your office, apparently, is now the motel for Fool for Love. So you've got two separate spaces that stay that way, But for Natoma, you've only got one space, which means you're going to have to convert Buried Child into Lie of the Mind back and forth, right?
Yeah. I mean, True West takes place in a kitchen. Fool for Love is in a motel room. Those make sense to be in different spaces. And Buried Child is in a Illinois like farmhouse. And Lie of the Mind takes place in a few different places. I think Minnesota, and it kind of jumps around. So the set designer, Steve Decker, did a wonderful job of kind of a neutral space that can be easily, it's actually pretty easily transformed into the other show. There are certain battles I chose not to take on this rep, mostly because once we've shown that we can do it, I don't think there's anyone that's going to come in and go, well, you know, oh, Boxcar, you know, they couldn't do this. I was like, well, we could do it if we want to. We choose not to do it. So we've got enough things going on where moving all the seats and this around is more just a headache for us. We kind of want to focus on some other more difficult things, which doing four plays at once is pretty difficult.
Particularly since you're playing two roles in one of them, which we'll get into in a minute. You're listening to an interview with Nick Olivero, who's the artistic director, a director and an actor in Sam Shepard in Repertory, now playing at their two different theaters, actually three different spaces in two different theaters in San Francisco through two shows through April 7th and two through April 14th. There are two main characters in True West, and you and Brian Treebaum are alternating these two roles.
All the best ideas come when you're, like, not actually doing the thing. It's when you're talking about doing the thing. No, it's actually been really rewarding, but it's been a ton of work. It's interesting. You know, playing both roles, rehearsals was really confusing. You'd get confused on blocking, where you're supposed to stand. You know, just because you don't even know the lines yet. You don't know the character. Once we've gotten into performance, you just kind of get into the mode of the person you're playing that night. I'm the type of actor when I'm on stage, I usually know everyone's lines anyway. So it's just kind of the same thing. You just turn off that switch. You're not saying that person's lines. But, I mean, I usually end up just, you hear them so many times, you just learn them. And so you just don't say them. That's kind of how it is performing. But the rehearsal process was really arduous. I mean, it was incredibly tasking. We worked a very long time, many, many months, 6 hours a day, on an hour-and-a-half play. I mean, but to really get it to where it needed to be, we had to put in the time.
There's also a lot of fight choreography. Has that ever gotten out of hand?
You know, the room for accident is always there. We had, we call it like the great whiteout fiasco of 2012, because there's a typewriter, so we had whiteout on the table. I think it was me. I kept doing it. I would move the typewriter angrily as Lee. Whenever I would play Lee, you know, you move it angrily. And I guess I smashed the whiteout bottle. And so the whiteout spilled on the table. So then we noticed that there was this whiteout on the table. Okay, we would communicate, you know, there's whiteout on the table. So we got new whiteout. And then like a week later, fell off the table and then got stepped on. And there was whiteout all over the floor. Treebaum, when we were doing the big fight at the end, he slipped on it. Didn't hurt himself, but, you know, it could have been dangerous. Stage manager said, how about we just take the whiteout out of the whiteout container? We said, oh, this is a brilliant idea. So then we had the problem with this empty bottle that just kept falling over because there was nothing in it. So finally, and she's like, well, then I'll put sand in it. And it just kept going. I mean, we've been running since January. So, I mean, you know, all this has happened over the course of a month. And so finally, we're like, just get rid of the whiteout. So the whiteout's gone. But there's been some little things here and there, you know, after 20 performances, something could, you know, happen. But we've gotten very good at when you're doing a fight, you're looking at the space and you're kind of keeping an eye on it because we do destroy it so much before the fight of really trying to protect and getting stuff out of the way and clear of where we're going to be. So we find little ways to communicate with one another and when to, you know, okay, we need to slow this down because something's in the way or watch this. So we really watch out for each other.
How many typewriters do you use?
We use two.
One that's beaten
There's
up.
One that's beaten to hell. And God, I pray that it will just last until April. I've repaired it a few times now. And then there's the one that we type on, which is also falling apart for some odd reason. I guess we don't know how to use a typewriter. Not my generation.
Nick Olivero, Peter Matthews left. Why?
The company has grown tremendously from, you know, our original $800 budget to, you know, we're almost a $200,000 company and now three spaces, two locations. And, I mean, I'd like to move into a larger theater and more of a multi-complex and, you know, looking at all the different programming that we want to do. Ever since the company started, he had two careers. He had the career in the arts and then he had an advertising career. And that career, because he's incredibly talented, has just grown as the company has grown. And so now he has two beyond full-time jobs. Between that and, you know, now he's happily partnered and looking to buy a condo. And, I mean, he's living the life. I'm over here going, what am I doing? So it just made sense. And it was, I mean, it was his decision. But it was one of those that, you know, when we had the conversation, it was like, so, yeah. I'm like, yeah. But it took us about 2 months to even get the room together. I mean, we're both so incredibly busy. But so it wasn't a shock. I said, oh, okay, let's have some wine and watch some TV. And that was pretty much the conversation. It was pretty straightforward.
Little Shop of Horrors was an amazing production.
Thank you.
We went outside. Beginning, you're on Natoma just hanging out, and there's this really awful band playing, seedy band, and there's people walking up and down, and suddenly a whole bunch of them begin singing. During this performance I saw, when we come out the second time for the scenes with the dentist, there was an actual homeless person who kept intruding into the story, and the various actors were keeping him on the side. It's a unique and wonderful experience. However, you made changes. Many changes in the show. You did that without the permission of the licensee, and you got closed down, unless you would agree to go back. So my question to you is, why that many changes when there could have been a way to do what you did and still maintain the original script?
To do what we did, I guess I would probably disagree that the changes were necessary to do what we did. And that's where those choices came from. I mean, to kind of, you know, and obviously this created, you know, a bit of a storm in the theater community on a very local and also a national level, which was not the intention. I mean, we were just trying to put together a show. And it never occurred to me that anybody would be interested in the 100 millionth production of Little Shop of Horrors at a 49-seat Black Box Theater on 6th Street. So given that, it was never an expectation to create or incite any sort of revolution or even discussion. From the moment we opened our mouths, we were shut down because we sang Skid Row as our opening song, which was actually the second song of the show. Little Shop of Horrors is the prologue. I looked at it and I was like, you know, there's no way to start the show with the correct song. We're going to start with Skid Row. So from that standpoint, we were in violation of our licensing agreement. And from there, you know, we looked at other things. Like, I started really kind of digging deep into the original show, the 1982 Off-Broadway show. And I love the 86 movie, which is based on it. And to be really clear, the changes that I made, and I think when people say changes, they're thinking I was writing new stuff. I wrote nothing. I took the 1982 Off-Broadway musical with the 1986 film version with the original 1966 Roger Corman film, which all of this is based on. And all the material was existing. It was found material.
But what about reorganizing the dentist's office to happen inside the basement?
I spent a really long time trying to figure that one out. That was the only time that I actually had to write anything, was to get the dentist to come to the flower shop. I tried to keep it as short as possible to just make it happen. Because we created this world. And the world was a living, breathing world. And everything happened in this world, except for the scene where Seymour's supposed to go to the dentist's office. And it just didn't make any sense to put a dentist office on this stage, because we weren't on a stage. We were literally in the flower shop. The outside was the outside. The lobby was turned into the flower shop. And the theater was turned into the back storeroom. And we kept the plant in the storeroom. So it started affecting all of these decisions we made. Because the plant was there, I had to create huge posters and put them in the window and say, this is the plant, come look at it. So people could, during intermission, see that the fake customers, so to speak, were going to the storeroom. I ended up using all this multimedia. I had all this live video because I had to stage scenes in the lobby. And so customers would come in throughout the show and they would buy things. And that needed to happen in the store, not in the back storeroom.
Why didn't you just extend that and put the dentist's office up on the screen?
Not on the screen. I actually thought about changing our dressing room into the dentist's office. So I was going to move intermission and then have the audience go through kind of like a museum. I thought about this for a long time. It didn't work. Go through the dressing room and see the scene happen. But I didn't know how I was going to be able to – it was going to be able to get 49 people in there at once. So I was like, well, maybe I'll do it in two or three stages. But then I got to entertain all of these people while they're not watching the scene. And then where do we dress? We have no dressing room. It's a cast of like 17 plus a band. So we really need our dressing room. And we have all these tons of – the set just kept changing because we had dead plants and live plants, and the plant kept growing. I'd weighed all those options and eventually just said, all right, we got to get the dentist here. So what's the best way? Oh, he makes house calls.
Then you interpolated another song from another show.
Oh, Time Warp?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. People love that.
That's really stretching the bounds, isn't it?
Sure. Once we got to the point where, I mean, we're in the second act now. Let's go back to the first act, which is all the licensing people only saw the first act. They didn't even have to see the second act. So there was a common misconception that the Time Warp is what got us shut down. They never saw it. What got us shut down was the moment we...
But they knew about it.
No, they didn't, actually.
They didn't?
No. Okay. I mean, maybe they heard about it later, but not when I was there. They knew nothing about the show when they came to see it. Nobody had said anything. Now, remember...
Why did they come?
Because they heard it was an awesome idea. They heard that, I mean, I don't say brilliant. I'm not trying to, you know, toot my own horn here. But we got an article on playbill.com. They caught wind of it and just heard that we were staging it outside. It was really gritty. It was new. It had a new take on it. You're talking about a show that's been done over and over again. And it's become a bubblegum show. I'm not trying to discredit any other production, by no means. I mean, I've seen them. I love the show. I go and watch it. Oh, I'll keep watching it. But Howard Ashman... In the script says, you know, you should really play this straight. Don't play the glam. Play it straight, and the comedy will come out. And I think there's a lot of productions that don't do that. Everyone tries to do their best Ellen Green impersonation. Well, that's not the character of Audrey. It doesn't need to be. It was just the original.
Right.
So there's a lot of, you know, things that don't need to be that way. It's just, it's not written in the script. It's written in that production. Taking something so iconic, and the music is, of course, wonderful, we started playing with what else was cut from the original, or what else were they inspired by? You're talking about a show that was inspired by another movie that is an adaptation of itself. We just kept riffing on that. We changed the dentist song, which is an amazing song. And we had, I remember conversations with my assistant director and my music director about whether or not we should remove the dentist song and put in the original draft, which was Hobby, which I ultimately said, look, people can see this song anywhere. They can go anywhere and hear this song. But this song has never seen the light of day, and we're doing a different production, so why not just go all the way?
The real complaint, and I can understand it, I mean, you're not going to take Fool for Love and start changing Sam Shepard's words.
No.
Yet you had no problem doing it with Little Shop of Horrors. Isn't there kind of an inconsistency there?
I'm not inconsistent that I feel, and again, this is where people disagree, and that's absolutely fine to disagree. I think it's okay for people to take something and make it their own. Do whatever you want with it.
Would that include Fool for Love?
If someone wanted to do that, I personally don't think you need to do anything to it. It runs an hour and 10 minutes. There's nothing wrong with the show. It doesn't need to be tightened. It doesn't need to be...
But you can take extrapolations from the Robert Altman film.
Sure, yeah.
And you think Sam Shepard would be?
He may not be. I would imagine Sam Shepard would not be. I've heard that he's not very open to that, as is Edward Albee and the Tennessee Williams estate. His estate is incredibly protective of the words of Tennessee Williams.
Well, the problem is not so much if Nick Olivero makes changes that improve the show. The problem is that once you open that door, you wind up getting people who are not Nick Olivero who are going to do things like, oh, change the ending of Rent, for example.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and then this it becomes very problematic.
For who? Some lawyers it's a problem for and a playwright.
But on the other hand, you
is
know,
it a problem for the audience?
Could be.
Could be.
Could be.
But you don't know until you try it.
But it's got a lot to do with copyright. I don't want somebody taking stuff that I've copyrighted.
Yeah.
That is my work, and then somebody sends me a letter and says, you know, your play sucked. Well, no, my play didn't suck.
And there's a big distinction between me taking a playwright's first play and making changes to it without their consent. But when was the last time a playwright worked with the director on the first play? The issue that we currently face in this world is that someone like me, who's in a 49-seat theater with a annual budget less than what these people are making per draft, has no contact with a playwright to say, hey, I have some changes I'd like to propose to you. So if I could have gotten Howard Ashman on the phone through the grave, I would have loved to have had the conversation. If I could have gotten the Mankin on the phone, I would be surprised. He could have responded anytime he wanted to. I think he probably doesn't want to be involved. And that's okay. That's his right. I've emailed Sam Shepard about these shows. You know, I went through his publicist and his literary agent and didn't hear anything back. And I talked to him on the phone, and they said, send us an email. We'll send it to Sam. And he's past this moment in his life. That's fine. I mean, I sought out John Cameron Mitchell to talk to him about changes that I would like to make in Hedwig. And all this is after Little Shop, of course. Now I'm more prone to attack and people being upset with it. So, you know, I'll go through the proper steps. And John Cameron Mitchell, at least I can get a hold of him, you know. But now I want to make a few more changes. He was in town. I just went and saw him and talked to him. But now I'm going through dramatists and it's incredibly difficult. Because you have a lot of people doing a production of Little Shop of Horrors. They don't want to be notified every single time there's a change. So they say, don't do it. Well, I personally think when you say don't do it, as opposed to do it, you're now limiting potential creativity. So let's say someone makes a change and Mimi lives at the end of Rent. I think it's a terrible idea. That's my opinion. Maybe the director thought it was a great idea. The audience will tell you for sure whether or not they buy a ticket or not. And that's how I think things are going to get settled. It's about the audience. It's about doing a show for an audience. You know, I think we start getting involved in a lot of egos and, you know, my ego and your ego and everyone's ego about what I think is this and this and that. At the end of the day, the audiences just would like to see a show. And I think we forget about that sometimes. You know, I got a lot of flack because people didn't think I was apologetic enough. Really, my take on it was, you know, we had a community who wanted to see this particular type of show. We had an overwhelming amount of support from the people who saw it. And I felt like we served our community and our audience very well. And gave them, you know, the things that we were trying to do. And everyone stood behind the work, all the people who put it up. And at the end of the day, that's really what I care about. I understand the law. I'm not an idiot. I'm not in a position to change the law. I'm not a congressman. I'm not a lobbyist. I'm not a Walt Disney Corporation. So I can't change these laws. So I have to abide by them, or obviously I have to break the law, which is what I did in that case. And now I'm looking to not break the law. I got caught. You know, people always say, but it was a good show. No one cares that it was a good show or not, you know, and that's kind of a shame, you know. I guess it'll be legendary, but probably for the wrong reasons, you know. I really wasn't trying to push a boundary, which is why I don't really bring it up. You know, people bring it up, and I kind of talk about it. But, you know, even just me talking right now, I'm sure you're going to have those listeners who are just going to be shaking their fists and cursing my name. And, you know, I figure we'll just go have a beer and say, sure, you know, you think one way, I think another. We just disagree on this.
Let's go back for a second to Sam Shepard and Repertory in the time that we have left. You have these four plays. A couple of quick questions. Fool for Love takes place in a motel room, and there's a TV set featuring a third character who is alive somewhere in the world talking. Well, but, I mean, within the context of the play, it's kind of a surreal thing. He's somewhere. He's alive, we assume. And he's talking to our characters and following their eyes. How did they do it in the original?
See, now we're talking. Now we're going back into changes too. Now this is fun. That's a huge change I made in the script. Well, not in the script, just in the play. And I don't think it ever occurred to maybe. I don't want to speak for Sam Shepard, but I'm going to bet that it probably didn't occur to anybody to do what I did. In the original script, the old man is off stage right in his own little world. He's just on a rocking chair, and he's sitting there, and the lights come up on him, and the lights go down, and he's just sitting there, and he's watching the show. In our production, he shows up on the motel TV. It seemed natural to me that there would be a TV in a motel room, and then why not use it? There's a big difference between 1982, 84, whenever the show came out with multimedia, and what we can do now. So someone asked me, they said, you know, what kind of changes did you make in Fool for Love? What kind of changes did you make in True West? You know, nothing to the script because it didn't need to be, but that was a huge change we made in just terms of presentation, which I didn't expect it to get people. That's what a lot of people walk away with. I mean, I think the acting from Brian Trebaum and Lauren Doucette is stellar, and the other two actors as well, Jeff Garrett and Jeff Libby, but people love that he shows up on the TV.
Now, I noticed again in Little Shop and True West and in Fool for Love, you're doing a lot of work with video, with multimedia. Is that something that you want to get more into?
No, I hate multimedia.
Really?
I've always complained about it. Every show I see, I usually think it's not implemented wisely. It doesn't make sense in the world a lot of times. So I think that's why I keep doing it lately, is that I'm trying to see how I can kind of play with it. Also, in a much bigger kind of uber scale, everything I'm really doing is working towards the biggest kind of production of my life, which is an adaptation of George Orwell's 1984, which would have an incredible amount of live and recorded video. It moves the audience around. And so all the things I've used from Little Shop and from Clue, how people watch the show, they're all fragments of me actually working out a process of how to approach a very large show that has about 50 people in it that would have an audience about 400 to 500 nightly.
Is the novel now in public domain?
No, it's in public domain in 14 years, but since Little Shop, of course, I've contacted the rights holders. And because it's about to go in public domain, they're much more willing to, because they want to make some money off of it, I would imagine. I mean, it makes sense to me. So I first came up with the idea in 2001, and there were no plays. In 2004, there were three plays. Last time I checked, which was June of last year, there were seven plays, and they asked for my outline. So they're willing to do it. I've read all the plays. I just contacted all the writers and wanted to see if my idea was similar to theirs, and it's incredibly different. So there were some similarities, but a lot of what I'm doing is just my own thing. Whether or not I need to wait 14 more years or when I can get the money to do the show, we'll see.
Well, there have already been two somewhat failed movies as well.
The problem with 1984 is that people try to relate it to contemporary culture. It's about the Iraq War. It's about right now.
It's about 1948.
It's about 1948, yeah. It's about every single year we've ever been in. I mean, that's the whole point. We're always on the brink of this. So you don't need to pinpoint it.
Actually, that's a comment that was made by William Gibson about 1984. He said it's not prescient at all. It's about 1948. That's when it was written, and that's when Orwell was writing about it. Absolutely. Hedwig and the Angry Inch. That's supposed to be this year?
Supposed to be. We'll see.
What do you have coming up after the Sam Shepard repertory?
Hedwig and the Angry Inch is on the docket. We're still pinpointing down a Hedwig, and we're kind of looking at some different things. My music director and myself, he's incredibly busy. Sam Shepard has proven to be. And with Peter leaving, there's just a lot of stuff that's going on where I'm kind of looking at whether or not producing another musical is what we should do right now. But our next big project is going to be Speakeasy, which I finally just pulled the trigger on and said, okay, I'm going to do this show, which is an original show, which is a speakeasy. The beauty of it is that it's set in 1928, which has a very, for those history buffs, has a very important meaning. There's a cabaret in the back room. There's gambling in another room. There's raids by the police. Everyone drinks out of a flask. There's tons of conflict. You have issues with the mob. Jazz bands will come in, and African-Americans will decide to go to the casino floor, and that's going to spark a race conflict. I mean, obviously, during that time frame, there's people who were drinking away their life fortune, losing their wife, losing their kids, losing their money, losing their job, so there's a lot of content to find in there.
And the play is already written?
No, not at all. Working on it. It writes itself. It's a theatrical event. Okay. It's a party with pieces. So I'm assembling the group who's going to be working on it, and there's a lot of really excitement surrounding it. And we're looking at probably not being one of our, it may be in the studios if we use the whole space, but we're looking at about like 10,000 square feet of basement space.
Quick question. The two people in the shows that I've seen that really astonished me were Megan Trout as Shelley in Buried Child and Brian Treebaum. Yeah. Just incredible in those two roles.
This is our first production with Megan. I know she just did a show at Aurora with Tom Ross, and he just had nothing but good things to say. She's Shelley and Barry Child. She's also Beth in Lie of the Mind. And you'll see in her another hard role. And Brian Treebaum plays three roles, Austin and Lee and True West and Eddie and Fool for Love. We started working, the first show we did was Museum, and then we cast him in the Tennessee Williams. And him and Lauren Doucette and myself were the three actors from Tennessee Williams that are back again. And I really enjoy working with him and Lauren. They're both phenomenal. And so I try to keep those really talented people happy and close and keep giving them work.
You've been listening to an interview with Nick Olivero, who's the artistic director of Boxcar Theater, now showing Sam Shepard in repertory, True West through April 7th, Buried Child through April 7th, Lie of the Mind through April 14th, and Fool for Love through April 14th. And you have to go to the website Boxcar Theater, that's theater with an re.org, to find out exactly what days they're playing
and
on
where.
And where. I'm Richard Walensky on Open Book.